The Association of Classical and Christian Schools presents Repairing the Ruins, the 2013 ACCS Annual Conference, copyright 2013. If you have purchased this audio CD, you are free to make multiple copies of it for your own or your school's use. You may not sell copies of this audio or post it on the internet. To find out more about ACCS, or to order additional conference talks, visit our website at accsedu.org. Look for the Conferences tab. Thank you for your support of ACCS.
Well, it is 8:30, and it is early, but we're going to go ahead and get started. I'm going to go ahead and open us up in prayer and then introduce myself, and we'll get going. Heavenly Father, we thank you for your graciousness in giving us the opportunity to gather and to fellowship with so many like-minded folks who are laboring towards the same ends, towards your glory. Father, we thank you that you are so gracious to us to give us this time and this opportunity. Thank you for each of these folks and for their hard work and desire to honor and glorify you. Lord, we ask your blessing on this time, and we pray this in your name. Amen. Well, before we get going here, I want to thank Jason and Brett. They did a great talk on math on Thursday, which was I really appreciated. And as they were going through and presenting, I thought, ooh, I can use that in my presentation as well. And the same thing ended up happening yesterday with Jim Nance's discussion, those of you who were there, on physics as a liberal art. So I've really enjoyed those, and I think as we go through this morning, you'll be able to see some of the common themes and some of the common elements come out in all three of those presentations, which is encouraging. As classical Christian math educators, we're hopeful that we're headed in the same direction. So, and then the one other note before we get started here, there's two pages of notes in your outline. I'm going to spend probably about 40 minutes on the first page and 10 minutes on the second page. So as we're going along here and you're thinking, oh my, are we going to be here for 80 minutes by the time I end that second or that first page? The second one will go quicker. The topic is imitating consistency, math as character formation. And this topic came to me, something I've been wrestling with over the past year intensely, but it's been in the background for me for the past 8 or 9 years. I teach at the Oaks in Spokane, Washington, and I've been there for 8 years, heading into my 9th year, and have taught a variety of classes, math, science, Bible. But this question that came to me as I was wrestling on the way home one day last summer was, what are the marks of a mature Christian? What is it that characterizes someone who is mature in their faith? And the same time that I was wrestling with that question, I'm also wrestling with school starts. I got to get ready for that. But as I was thinking about a mark of a mature Christian, one of the things that came to my mind is, as you get all of these storms that come into your life, things that you didn't see, you get blindsided by this, you get blindsided, your car breaks down, you know, you've got conflict in this area, you get these different storms that come into your life. One of the marks of a Christian in the midst of that is that they're not blown and tossed about by the wind, that they're anchored. And another way I think we can say that is that they're consistent. One of the marks of a mature Christian would be consistency. And you would see this also in decision-making processes. You know, there's a tough situation. How are you going to handle this discipline case in the classroom? How are you going to think through this other situation maybe at home? Someone who's a mature Christian, they make a decision, and you can sit back and go, wow, that was a great idea. Where did that come from? As you get back and you look at 20/20 hindsight, you can see that, wow, that is actually consistent with the Scriptures. And so this whole question of consistency in a mature Christian was something that was interesting to me. This was all kind of percolating. And then I had an opportunity to write an article for classes this last winter, I believe it was. And so, imitating consistency, how do we do this? The question that came to my mind, though, in that article is the central question that I want to address with you all today. And the question is, how does a math problem shape who we are? How does a math problem shape who we are? So what I want to do in this workshop is to trace the effects of knowing mathematics thoroughly to the character-forming implications that knowledge has. I want to walk all the way through. Once we know math thoroughly, how does that shape our character? Now, some of you may have had this dilemma. When we start talking about Christian worldview of math, you start to feel we're either going to do worldview really well, and the math is just going to kind of fall by the wayside, or we're going to do the math really, really well, go for good test scores, good understanding, and the Christian worldview is going to slide. So is this a choice that we're forced to make, good math or good Christian? I came into this thinking I want to emphasize good worldview. That was the part that just intrigued me. It was the question that I would just want to percolate on and chew on over and over and over. But the interesting thing is as I've found myself thinking about the Christian worldview and wrestling, that whole process has brought me around to the point of how do we teach math excellently? And as I'm thinking about teaching math excellently, we're going back over and teaching Christian worldview. And I think the two actually fit together. When you teach math well, the Christian worldview pops. And when the Christian worldview pops, you're teaching math excellently. And so that's one of the things that we're going to go look at, is how that cycle, how those two fit together. I had one of those moments that Chesterton talks about in the beginning of Orthodoxy, where you storm up onto this beach, I got it, I discovered something, and then you realize, oh, everybody knew this all along. I don't know if that's ever happened to you. But there's a book that I've read 4 or 5 times, and you've probably read it at some point as well. It's called The 7 Laws of Teaching. You've heard it mentioned a number of times. But the first law of teaching says that a teacher must know that which he must teach. And at first glance, you look at this and go, well, of course. It's almost like it's a level of achievement. You have to get to this point, and once I get there, then I can teach. You keep reading through that chapter, and you keep reflecting on it, and all of a sudden, this law feels like just a deep abyss. You go, whoa, where's the bottom? How do I know that which I would teach? What does that even mean? And so, what does it mean to know mathematics? Is one of the questions that ends up coming to us as we read through and wrestle with this first law of teaching. This is early in the morning, but I want to take the word mathematics out and substitute in the word wine. What does it mean to know wine? We'll ask that question first, and then we'll bring that back in and use it to help us to understand mathematics. So what does it mean to know wine? Some of you might know wine really well. Some of you might not. But if we start talking about wine, we might say that it comes in 2 colors. You've got red and you've got white. And those that know wine well can immediately start to think of all those examples that are kind of in the middle, sort of blur the line. Some of us might think that the blurring between the red and the white is not rinsing out a glass all the way or something. But the point is, the extent that you know wine is the extent that you're able to talk about the categories of it, the different regions maybe, or blends, or all the different ways that you could go through and categorize wine. And the point is, as we know math better, we can categorize it better. And as we go through and we wrestle with the categories, that actually reinforces our own understanding as well. So do this for me for just a minute. Most of us in here teach a math class of some kind. In your math class, pick one and think through the categories of concepts in that class that you teach. So do that for just a moment for me. I really appreciated Brett Edwards was mentioning this on Thursday, the critical concepts list that he's working through and developing. That's a great example of this type of an activity. But when we were talking about wine, we categorized it based off of color, red and white. On what basis do you go through and categorize your math lessons? Do you do it based off of similar techniques? Do you do it based off of similar problems that you're attempting to solve? What is the basis for categorizing? What I'm going to show you in this next slide are 4 elementary math concepts. They're a little easier for us to grab onto right off the bat. So four elementary math concepts. You've got subtraction with regrouping, multi-digit number multiplication, division by fractions, perimeter and area. So these are four different math concepts, and we usually think of these as totally separate. The question I have for you, though, is what's the common concept? What would be common between all of these? Is there a way that I could take these four concepts and mash them together into one? I can't answer that unless I really understand each of those four. So what would it be? Three basic laws of arithmetic. You've got the associative principle, the commutative principle, and the distributive principle, all in play in those in some way, some fashion. And as I look at those concepts in terms of those laws, I start to see the concepts differently. Now, textbooks, they'll always categorize. They'll always group concepts together. And so I'm going to show you the algebra text that we use. This is Jacob's algebra. I imagine a number of you probably use the same. How many use Jacob's algebra in here? Raise your hand. Okay, several. This text categorizes its lessons. How does it categorize it? Well, you look, first thing that you see in the table of contents, if you just open up a book, look at the beginning, you've got chapters. Chapters are just natural categories, and the textbook authors have set this up. It starts out with fundamental operations, and you've got functions and graphs, and it goes on, chapter after chapter after chapter, broken up into nice categories, all the way through chapter number 17. Have you ever stopped to wonder why they put those chapters together in that order? Why does that happen? We'll do that typically. What I want to ask you now, though, is what would be the 3 to 5 concepts that are taught in this book? How could we take those 17 chapters and look at it not in terms of 17 chapters, but 3 or 4 main ideas? And what would they be? We went through one of our math teachers. We're really blessed at the Oaks to have 2 teachers that teach math full-time. I teach. I didn't teach any math this last year. I've taught it in the past. But we have math teachers, and we have discussions about these things. And so I ask our math teachers, in algebra, in geometry, and in calculus, what are the main ideas? You get between 3 and 5 categories. What would you say? And so with the textbooks that we use, these were the basic ideas that we came up with. We didn't wrestle too long about it. The longer that we looked at them, the less satisfied we got. And it gave rise to productive wrestling as teachers with just what are proper categories. How do you think about these lessons? And so these are some of the key concepts that we came up with. After this point, after identifying the key ideas, we can look for connections. And so we'll do this with the algebra, the 3 main ideas in algebra that we came up with. So those ideas, basic operations with polynomials, graphing functions, solving linear equations with one variable, those were the 3 key ideas. Now the fun part. What's the common concept? What is the central thing that you're doing in an algebra class? You can see if you disagree with me on this one or not. You're welcome to do that afterwards. I'd be happy to talk with you about it. Arranging and rearranging knowns and unknowns. And you do this in different ways. A graph is arranging knowns and unknowns. And it's related, we know, to solving equations with different variables. But as we teach our students this, we usually have these different sections as we go through the year, and yet there's this theme that runs throughout all of them, and it's arranging and rearranging knowns and unknowns. So all of this, all of these categories, we're talking about this for the sake of helping us as teachers to wrestle with how well do we know our subject. So let's go back to the first law of teaching. The teacher must know that which he would teach. Now, I'm going to take you into a little bit of a longer quote in just a second here, and Brett also alluded to this quote in his talk on Thursday. I'm going to spend a little bit more time on it. As you read through and John Milton Gregory develops what this means, you come to a section where he says, "What men call knowledge is of all degrees," and we've seen this with our students, we've seen it in ourselves, we've felt it, from the first glimpse of truth to the full understanding. At different stages, the experience of the race as we acquire it is characterized by, and this would be a great time to review what Brett went over on this before, but the first is faint recognition. There's just, it's familiar in some way. At the next point, they're able to generally tell it to others. And we see this, and this is what you see often when you have someone coming up and asking you a question. Then there's this point, the power to readily explain, to prove, to illustrate, and to apply a problem. When we hit this point, students are acing their math problems. We are jacked. This is a great thing. We're excited. We send them off to college. They can have careers. This is good. We are excited. The only problem is that John Milton Gregory doesn't leave us there. He says, and. He gives us a fourth level, and we kind of go, uh-oh. Here we go. So what's the fourth level? What would you put there? Such knowledge and appreciation of the truth in its deeper significance and wider relations. Now, as I read this book and I reread Seven Laws, I came to this and I would read it and I would think, you know what? Deeper significance, wider relations, what that means, that is just code. And that's code for subject integration. That's code for the point where I need to be able to bring history in, I need to be able to bring in Bible, I need to be able to bring in literature. Oh boy. This is huge. How do I do? And it's just, but I think there's something else in view here. We're talking about the knowledge. We're talking about this process of understanding. These deeper connections and wider relations are within math. It also includes the other things. It includes the subject integration. But so much of math, that there's so much depth and value and riches to the subject, that there's deeper significance in math, there's deeper significance and wider relations. So what do we mean by depth? What would we mean if we're talking about this in the context of math and deeper significance? Depth would mean connecting the concepts with more fundamental ideas. So whatever problem you're dealing with, maybe the quadratic formula or something, that quadratic formula has deeper ideas and themes that run all throughout it and actually serve to connect it with the other concepts around. So it would be appealing to the more fundamental ideas of a subject. And then we get to breadth. What would breadth mean? Breadth is going to mean connecting the concept with similar ideas. And I'm going to go through and go back to the elementary and the algebra examples that we just walked through, and we're going to ask, are these examples of depth or are they examples of breadth? So here's our elementary concepts. And we're looking at subtraction with regrouping and all of the others, and we said all of these have a common concept of three basic laws. This would be an example of depth. We're appealing to a more fundamental explanatory principle that helps us to understand this. And then we can go back to algebra and we can look at this in terms of, I skipped ahead of myself, sorry. Arranging and rearranging knowns and unknowns. When we look at this one, depth or breadth? This is depth. I mean breadth, pardon me. This is breadth. It's helping us to understand what's common in each of these scenarios. So it's not explaining why we can do it, but it's explaining or describing how we perform these operations. So let's go back to what brought us to all this quote. Such knowledge and appreciation of the truth in its deeper significance and wider relations. This takes us a lot of time and energy. Why should we do it? As teachers, what's the reason to go to a fourth level? We spend enough time on the third. Why go to the fourth? That by the force of its importance, we act upon it. This is talking about the knowledge at this fourth level. Our conduct is modified by it. The reason to push to the fourth level, to put the energy in, it's tough, and it's a long period of time that it takes for us to get there, is so that we can shape students. The seven laws of teaching don't have just SAT scores or careers in mind as you go through and you read this. Seven laws of teaching have something much more valuable. It's about shaping kids. It's about changing lives, and it's about changing lives with the stuff that we teach, with the mathematics that we cover. At the Oaks, we often refer to education as character formation. This is what it takes for us to get there. Now, this character formation comes about when the force of the importance of our lesson moves our students to action. Some concepts in areas, sometimes the force of the importance is felt right off the bat. Right there. Wow. So one example of this, the first one that came to my mind, many of you have read Les Mis, or if you haven't read it, you might have seen the recent movie. And there is a powerful scene in there where forgiveness is shown. When Jean Valjean receives the candlesticks, they're his now. And that moment of forgiveness that you see there, it hits you. Wham! And it is powerful. That can move you to action. With mathematics, it's usually not that quick. Rarely does the force of the importance of a concept just hit you. You might be able to multiply three-digit numbers. You can factor trinomials. You can do all of these things. But even then, the force of the importance is something that we have a hard time communicating. And I think part of this is because we're stopping with problem solving. So we don't progress far enough to feel the force of math's importance because of the time and the intentionality that's required to get there. We labor through our textbooks. We go through the rigors of problems and assignments, the pressure of completing a chapter or a text, and often what that means is we have a sort of myopic vision. We recognize the math concepts when we're right up next to them, when we're right there, but as we step back, the daily lessons and all of those concepts, you'll remember Jim Nance's slide yesterday when he had all the physics equations there. You look at all of those physics equations and you kind of start to go, whoa, they're blurring. I'm starting to lose it. And yet what he was suggesting there is take all of those equations away and look at it in terms of here are key fundamental concepts. And the point there was to show the unity, show this as a unified subject. So what we want to do is we want to look at math in terms of the big picture. And we want to start to see the big picture. Some of you may have watched a video on YouTube, and it's called The Powers of 10. Has anyone ever seen that before? Yeah. What happens is you're focused in on a little patch of ground, and they slowly zoom out, and they zoom out, and they zoom out, and pretty soon you get this beautiful picture of the whole world, and then they go back out to the edge of the galaxy. I'm not quite sure how they manage that. But they get all the way out past the galaxy, and they're able to look at all the galaxies, and it's this incredible image. We can do the same thing with math, with our math lessons, in zooming out. And part of the reason to do that is to address this myopic vision where we look at math in terms of a sequence of lessons. But the problem is math isn't, as you know, discrete units. It's not some mosaic that's made up of fragmented lessons that just kind of go here and here and here. And so we don't want to teach that way. There's a book that some of you may have seen before, Knowing and Teaching Elementary Mathematics. I've really enjoyed reading through this one and would recommend it to you. But there's a quote in here where Liping Ma says, "Mathematics does not consist of isolated rules, but of connected ideas." There's not a big picture to math if it's isolated rules. There's a big picture to math if there's connected ideas. And this is challenging. This is a question that I've asked myself, particularly as I taught through a statistics course. Why am I teaching this individual lesson? Am I teaching it so that I get to the end of the chapter or to the end of the book? What's the reason for it? And originally, the first 2 years, I think, was all about getting to the end of the chapter and getting to the end of the book and trying to make it. But as I kept going through that process, it was bringing up the question of, well, why would this be here? What's the purpose? So the question that we can ask ourselves, am I thinking of the concepts as connected or treating them as isolated rules? Another way to get at the same idea is a Chinese proverb, know how and also know why. Know how and also know why. We referred to this in our panel, the math panel the other day. When you're thinking about math knowledge, and just this is another way, another analogy for the big picture of math, but you can think of it as a multi-story building. There's a foundation, and any of you who've built or read anything on building, one of the key things is the foundation. If that foundation's off, there's problems the rest of the way through. And how many times do we run into that, that we're teaching pre-algebra, we're teaching geometry, and there are holes, there's problems, there's foundations, which are typically manifested with the question, it's too hard. Math goes in steps. It builds. And so if it's too hard, there's been a missed step somewhere along the road. Another way to think of mathematical knowledge is to parallel the way that you can understand math with the way that a taxi driver understands his city. Taxi driver has to be able to get from A to B. And he needs to be able to do that in traffic and out of traffic. He needs to do that quickly. There may be a time when he needs to take a long route. I'm not sure why that would be. But he needs to have a complicated and a flexible understanding of the roads. What we're hoping our graduates leave with is a complicated and a flexible understanding of mathematics. Excellent math students have the ability to zoom out and see the big picture. You may have had one or two of these come through your classes, and they get it. It's just part of them. They understand it. And I think part of that is because they get this big picture view. So this is the point as we go through. We started out talking about Christian worldview. We're all the way through now talking about the point of how do we teach math excellently? What makes an excellent math student? And yet at the same time as we get to this point, we're talking about a big picture. What does the big picture of math reveal? And this is the same point where we start talking again about Christian worldview. The question is what does the big picture of math reveal? What does it show? If I look at all of these connected ideas, what is revealed? The process of studying math year after year after year, it gets into us, and it has the effect of implanting a sort of abstraction. Math's all about reasoning and relationships. There's reasoning and there's relationships. We do this over and over and over, and it starts to get inside of us. The big picture of math is about relationships and reasoning, and those are abstract. We try to make them concrete, and we start our lessons that way, but we end up talking about abstractions. And so one of the things that, and you'll have to just bear with me for a minute here, one of the things that I think is helpful about that, making it abstract, is that we can use abstract art to help us understand the big picture. So hold on for just a second with me on that one. One of my favorite painters is Mikado Fujimura. Has anyone heard of Mikado Fujimura in here? Oh, good, thank you. He wrote a book called Refractions. It's fun. I had a chance to go to New York and look at his gallery and look at some of his paintings. They're beautiful. It's an ancient Japanese method of painting called Nihonga, and they take minerals and they take some sort of rabbit something or other. Anyways, they take all these pigments and minerals and they mash them together into this paste and they put it onto some sort of a canvas, and they can be huge, but it's sort of an abstract painting. Well, one of the things about Mikado Fujimura is he's huge in the Christian arts community. And he was commissioned by the publisher Thomas Nelson to go through and to make a painting of that would illuminate a reprinting of the four Gospels, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. And his paintings were going to illuminate that manuscript. Here's one that he did for that. You look at that and you go, okay, what's going on here? This is called The Tears of Christ. It's not Christ and there's no tears. What it is it's a reflection after he sat and he would read through and he would wrestle with it and he would say, all right, what are the relationships? What are the things going on as I read about the tears of Christ in the Gospels? The big picture of math is similar to abstract art in that it is digested through reflection and practice, doing it over and over. That picture, in all honesty, is not going to mean anything to you until you look at it for maybe 10 or 15 minutes and you ask questions of it. The same thing happens with math. The big picture doesn't tell us anything until we start asking questions of it. And we can borrow questions. So artists that we can borrow, or questions we can borrow from our artist friends are, what are the themes in the big picture of math? Where is the beauty in the big picture of math? And this is my favorite. What's unique? What is it that's unique about math? We know in our gut when we're talking about math. What is it that's unique? Does anyone know who this guy is? I got a couple head nods. This is Georg Cantor. Now, he did a whole lot of work on infinity, and he did end up going crazy. But before he went crazy, he had a perspective on math that is far beyond what I'm even going to attempt to have in my lifetime. He saw math way zoomed out. And this is one of his observations. The concepts of mathematics are linked only by the necessity of being consistent. What Cantor does for us is to point out the ever-present theme of consistency in math. He even goes so far as to give it the role of glue, connecting concept to concept. When you start with counting, when you build up through multiplication, exponents, all the way up functions and limits, you end up with a massive web of reasoning that is incessantly consistent. There are right answers, there's wrong answers. There's proper ways, there are improper ways to do your math. In fact, part of the beauty of math is that you can trace the concepts in a calc class back to their roots, even down as third grade, into the elementary math. You see the ideas being developed at that point. Consistency. That's what's all the way through this. It's one of the key themes in math, I believe. Now, as Christians, as classical Christian educators, we're concerned with going to the source. We want to go all the way back. Where does this come from? And we know where the source of consistency is, don't we? The scriptures answer this question for us. They clearly reveal where the origin of the theme of consistency comes from. And in the book of Hebrews, we read that Christ upholds all things by the word of his power. And the thing that we're talking about now is math. And that's what he upholds. It is held together in Christ, and it's not some mere coincidence that this is occurring, but it is a continual and a willful act that God keeps math consistent. This is one of my favorite psalms, favorite verses out of the Psalms that touches on this as well. Whatever the Lord pleases, he does. Whatever the Lord pleases, he does. Whatever is done pleases the Lord, and he's doing it. In heaven and in earth. Psalm 135, verse 6. By studying math, one of the things that we're doing is we're taking the faithfulness and consistency of God and we're putting it under a microscope. And we're measuring it. There's a sense in which we're measuring God's consistency. And it's what you teach your students every day. As we wrestle with this, we can begin to get an extent of the mystery of God's faithfulness by looking at our own efforts to be consistent. So we're going to look at this as how we try to be consistent in our own classes and in our own homes. Most of us will be teachers and parents, and we seek to raise our kids, our students, in the nurture and admonition of the Lord. This is a picture of our third grade classroom, beginning of the year, this past year. But we seek to do that, and as we seek to raise kids in the nurture and admonition of the Lord, what we have to do is give guidelines, and we give rules. There's a problem with that. As soon as you give those, you've got to follow through on them. And you need to bless those that are doing it well, and you need to discipline those who aren't. We can't handle that many things to be consistent with. In our classes and at home, it is so easy to give more rules than we can be consistent with. And I'm sure you've had that. We have a three-year-old at home. And even at three, they could remind you when you're not being consistent. It is so easy for us to do. And so what do we do as teachers, as parents? We limit the number of things that we need to hold folks accountable on, and we pick the key ones. Otherwise, we don't have a hope. But parenting and teaching both serve to highlight the depth and breadth of God's consistent governance. Our lack highlights his strength. Pick one object. Let's take a triangle. You take three lines, end to end, hook them together, make a three-sided polygon. How many relationships are there in one triangle? Think about how many lessons, let's say kindergarten through sixth grade first. How many lessons kindergarten through sixth grade are just on triangles, are related to triangles in some way? I asked our elementary principal about that, and she said, maybe in the realm of 60 to 80, somewhere in there. Think 7 through 12 now. How many lessons in 7 through 12 are spent related to a triangle in some way? I think we could probably come up with the same number. So let's say 80 in both. K through 12, 160 lessons on a triangle. God upholds that many relationships just when you take three lines and hook them together. Well, you're not probably done understanding triangles even at that point. Christ upholds at least that many relationships in every triangular spatial relationship. At all times and in all ways, triangles function the same way. It's something that you have to digest by reflecting on, by asking questions about. Every time we work a problem or introduce a concept, we assume God's consistency, and we highlight the theme of consistency, as Cantor pointed out. I'm going to show you an example here with triangles. We're going to just parachute right into the middle of the geometry year. So the textbook that we use, this is in chapter 7, and it's the third lesson. And it gives you this particular objective, to apply the properties of the altitude of a right triangle. So basically what you're going to do is you're going to take the triangle, you can see A, B, C there, and you're going to take an altitude and drop it down. So from C down to D, that's that line there, C to D. So that's the altitude. And we're going to start playing with it and see what we can do. Well, here's a problem that comes later on in this section. Have you guys noticed the speakers haven't buzzed yet? This has been the room, the whole conference, where the speakers have buzzed. And I was a little nervous about that. I think it's going to scare me. I'm going to jump partway through. But here's a problem, a sample problem, that's at the end of that section. So you have a diagram similar to the one that I just showed you. And you go through and you name the altitudes. You find the value, the height of the altitude. And then you calculate the area of a triangle. So if our students are having a bad day, if they're tired, not feeling like working, when they hit this problem on their assignment, what do? Flip back through and find the definition of altitude. With the definition of altitude comes an explanation that they need to provide, and they can write that down. As soon as they get that done, that's boom, check the box, A's done. B, part B says to find the altitude, the value of it. I find triangle that comes with a handy dandy little equation located right there. Plug and chug. I just had to crack up when Jason used the example of cake and a goose and chickens. It doesn't matter what you're talking about. Just find something that's close, plug in the numbers, and go. That was a great analogy. But that's the resort tendency, especially when we're tired. And then we have another equation to take care of another section in the text to take care of finding the area of a triangle. This slide's ugly. Of all the slides in this presentation, this one's the most ugly. And it's on purpose, because there's a sense of ugliness to this sort of an approach. It's just get it done. And yet, it's the default. And one of the things that we have to be able to do as teachers is to present beauty. And beauty in the sense of how we even approach a problem like this. So as we introduce the lesson, part of what we're wanting to do is to set the students up so that they're not coming at this problem from this approach. That's a challenge. I think one of the ways that we can do that is as we come to this lesson, we can ask, what are the deeper significance? What's the deeper significance in this lesson? What are the more fundamental concepts that we can appeal to? This was a fun exercise. Our math teacher, we wrestled through, all right, what are the deeper ones? What can we find here? We came up with this three, and there was a fair bit of debate on this one. So deeper concepts, the meaning of proportionality. Not just that it can be put into an equation, not just that we can see that, but the meaning of proportionality. What does that mean? And when I look at this as the meaning of proportionality, this is just another example of something that we've been working over and over and over for years now. And there is something satisfying in saying, oh yeah, this is just like what we did before. There's some gut level satisfaction in that. Similarity is a deeper concept. And then definitions. What does altitude mean? If I look at this triangle, how many altitudes are there? Well, I've got one drawn from C to D, but there's three. And if I understand the definition deeply, then I can get that. And so it's also an opportunity to reinforce, you know, why are we so precise with wording in our definitions in mathematics? That's critical, and we need to know that. And so there's a deeper concept there. While we're also looking at deeper, we're looking at broader. So broader, and this list right here, the way that I generated this list is by going and looking for problems that came before, lessons that came before, and for lessons that come after that this would be helpful for. So if I were going to teach this lesson 7.3, one of the things that we would do is to start out practicing and reviewing mental rotations and translations. It's a broader concept. They've done it before, and it's going to make this a lot easier. So for example, I've got triangle BDC. If I separate out triangle CDA, rotate it 90 degrees, then they look similar at that point. And so there's a practice that can help them by saying, all right, here's some broader concepts. This lesson is also a great setup for basic trig definitions, which are going to come just a little bit later. So keeping an eye on the broader field here is helpful for that. So both lesson 7.3 and problem number 33 that I was showing you become to the student a natural progression in their understanding of triangles because it's connected to the key ideas of geometry as you're going through. Having grasped the deeper concepts, then you can go through and you can zoom out and you can say, all right, we're talking about one concept. And you could do this at the end of a lesson real quickly. I've got a right triangle. This is a special case, but think of all the other lessons that we've done on triangles. Connect it to what they've seen before. And you can ask them this question even. What are some of the other types of triangles? How does this connect? It's an opportunity not just to connect to triangles, but also to show the uniqueness of the problem that you were just doing as well and how it can connect. And even from there, you could go out farther and just say, hey, basic triangles. What's a quick review of some basic triangles? And doing that in a way that draws out the deeper concepts that you've been trying to get them to see all the way along through the course. As we wrestle with this, and as kids start seeing the deep concepts repeated over and over and over, there's a cumulative effect that we shoot for. And this is another thing that Jim mentioned in his presentation yesterday. What are they going to remember when they leave? They're probably not going to remember the exact definition of an altitude. But what they're going to remember are these deeper concepts that spread all the way through, and they remember the unity of the concept, and they can have an appreciation of the beauty. Now, the other thing I wanted to mention on that is part of this beauty and this force is that it's found within math itself. Oftentimes, we're trying to go out into the world and find a real-world application problem because then we can show God's glory. I think part of what we're doing all year, every day, is showing God's glory in the math, not just how the math reveals God's glory outside. So if we come back to our original problem here, where we did problem number 33, what we want to prepare students to do is when they see this problem as we're teaching, it's an opportunity to bring back all of the, oh yeah, this is just like, and bring that back to play here. Once we get there as teachers, which is a real challenge, we're delighting in God's consistency. We're delighting in his incessantly consistent actions. And then one other side note before we go on. Consistency doesn't mean no surprises. In life, in math, it doesn't mean no surprises. We are surprised all the time by God. I was holding my son last night at dinner. We've got a little 7-month-old. He's in the back. And I pick him up. and I've got this nice white shirt on, and lo and behold, what happens? Boom! The floodgates open, and my nice white shirt is no longer nice and white. It's a surprise, but it's consistent. God is still teaching me. Be patient, be patient. Love your son. That happens in math, too. The beauty of something like calculus is that the consistency becomes curved. And the consistency is in motion now. And I think that is a really beautiful thing. If triangles are exhibitions of God's glory and consistency, one of the implications of that is that, in a sense, God is near. There is a proximity through, he's in our hearts, but he's also active in what we're working through to understand. It's not just in the real world where we see God's glory, but it is in math. And if God is near and he's in his math, how does that end up shaping our interactions in the classroom? And I'm going to run through a couple of examples here on what it would look like for a teacher and for a student. And I'm going to talk in terms of big picture. What does that look like? If you view math as something that reveals God, then what? Preparation. I think it is incredibly motivating to prepare and to be excited about math. For math's sake, it's something to delight in. You can do this through the course of the summer, and you can ask questions, and you can wrestle with it, and you can ask questions that are looking for God's glory. So the story was told yesterday about Kepler being dissatisfied with 8 minutes of air, out of 8 minutes of a degree in the calculations with Copernicus's model. There's a dissatisfaction because of the expectation of consistency. That's what we can find too. We can expect big themes. We can expect God to be revealing himself here. So preparation, class routines, and excellence. Class routines is one that I want to talk about briefly. What are the things that you just end up doing every day in class? What are the things that just repeat? Those sort of establish the cadence or the rhythm to your class. One of the things that we do is pray at the beginning of every class. What should that prayer look like? We actually have to teach that, don't we? We have to teach what a good prayer looks like at the beginning of class. What should we be asking for? The scriptures tell us what we should be asking for, but what should we be asking for at the beginning of class? We want to see, we want to understand, we want to have knowledge, not just those prayers that are help us to pay attention, help us to be awake, help us to not be tired, but we want to pray for help us to see the glory of the Lord revealed in this day's lesson. Shoot for those types of prayers. I had a student, he was a senior this last year, and it was in our physics class, and he prayed, this was towards the end of the year, he prayed. The prayer was so good, we just stopped. Amen, and then we just stopped. And we were all standing, because that's what we do at the beginning of class. We're standing, and I said, thank you. That was beautiful. And part of what was so beautiful about it is he was thanking the Lord for his beauty and glory. We've been working on this for a year, almost. And it was starting to come in, starting to see, hey, there is a big picture here. And it was beautiful. I'm going to relive that one over and over and over. Prayer at the end of class, when it's appropriate, when your students get it, when there's a, oh, I'm starting to see it. What is the Christian response? Well, what they've seen is God's glory. So how they should respond is how Christians respond when God shows himself. Give thanks. There's a teacher in our school who, I hear this every once in a while, down the hallway comes singing. It was beautiful. And it's incredibly fitting as well. And the third thing here is excellence. God's glory is revealed when we understand the medium that he's using to reveal it. And so we want to strive to understand the medium. We want to strive to understand math. Now, with a student, we want to cultivate some basic attitudes. Why does this work? If they're going to expect that God's consistent, that he has reasons for this, we want them to ask what the reasons are and to come at it from that way. We also want them to give thanks for understanding that he's given to them. And then the final thing up here is we want them to be searching for knowledge and process over answers. And we're hoping and we're praying that the full force of this hits them. The full force of this gets into them and moves them to actions. And so I think this question that I started with over the course of the year needs to be rephrased. How does the process of a math problem shape who we are? The math problem can be shaping, but it's because of the process that you go through. The work of a mathematician is not an answer, but it's a piece of reasoning. And it is the imitation of God's reasoning that shapes us into his image. And if math shows us anything, it shows us proper reasoning, God's thoughts. The big picture view of mathematics reveals the mark that God has placed on it, and it shows his character. His precision and consistency are glaring themes in the broad overview of math, and they can become characteristics of who we are as well. Now, this next slide, I think you'll be able to identify with. Obstacles. Me. The biggest obstacle is my own understanding, and this is what I wrestle with over and over and over. I don't understand it. I don't see the big picture yet. And once we have that recognition, the next question is time. When am I going to be able to do that? How do I find it? And then the third thing is, what are the good resources? How do I tackle this? Where do I go and look for the sources that are going to help me to get it? Knowing what to study and where to go. I think one of the best resources that you have, just off the cuff right now, is your own text. We talk about texts in humanities classes, and it's going to be the Divine Comedy, or it's going to be the Cost of Discipleship. In math, we have a text, and we usually use it just for problems and some examples, and maybe for the scope and sequence. But there's a lot of wisdom that is present, but we access it the same way that we would access the Cost of Discipleship. We ask questions. You already do a lot of what this is asking now. It's just asking different questions as you prep your lesson, as you go through the course of this, of a year in math. I'm going to tell you a couple of things that we've done at the Oaks that have been pretty helpful in sending us down this road. And the first one is something that we do is called Word Wednesday. Word meaning the Bible, Word Wednesday. So on Wednesdays, we're going to take 5 to 10 minutes, and we're going to talk about some scripture verse. The reason we did this is to make it incremental. How do you bring Christian worldview in? How do you get this? Well, we want to start, and we just want to do it. We want to be doing something. So we're going to look for some passages that relate, that are in the Bible that relate to math. And we've done it in different ways, where we make a list of 15 verses, and we're going to do one each week. And we've also done it where we take Acts 17:24, and we spend 6 to 8 weeks unpacking that verse. What does it mean that God is the maker? What does it mean that he's made everything? Does that include ideas? Does that include math? And we used the mathematical mind, which likes to go step by step by step by step and be analytical, and we just developed questions to ask of scripture texts. But the point of doing it all, of these Word Wednesdays, was to start somewhere and head in a direction. And the direction that we wanted to head in is to a point where we are able to not have to have Word Wednesdays. We want to get rid of them, but we need to start with them, so they're training wheels for us. And then those passages and those ideas are going to be coming through as we go into each of our daily lessons. Another thing that I would encourage you to do, and this is the great blessing of a conference like this, discussions, 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 discussions. Talk, talk, talk with anyone who will talk with you about it. Just keep talking about it. It's fun to see Jason and Brett, how they've been able to just form a dialogue because of their proximity. But the internet creates proximity, doesn't it? The world is flat, as they say. Reading and asking questions. we read books as a staff that don't have to do with math, and yet those are some of the most helpful books when it comes to teaching math. When we ask questions of the text, which is the math text. So I think it's great to read outside and read all over and to read broadly. And when you get into your math class, keep the same questions coming of the text in front of you. Ask your algebra text questions. One of the key features, knowing and teaching elementary math, is a comparison between Chinese math and American math. And one of the things that they say distinguishes Chinese math teachers from American math teachers is that the Chinese math teachers are continually wrestling with the meaning of their text. What does it say? Why is it here? What is the depth? What is the breadth? So some of the questions, just off the cuff, why is my textbook arranged this way? The textbook is a tool, and you can't use a tool if you don't know what it's intended for. You know that it teaches the subject, but why is it laid out that way? What is the foundational idea in my lesson? Ask yourself that each day. What is the foundational idea in your lesson? What is the foundation? If you just did that for 2 years, that's two cycles, you would have a great and a much deeper understanding of your math. And the last question is, what other lessons are similar to this? As you start, you know, prepping for next year and you're looking at the scope and sequence, where are the common themes? I taught statistics and for 6 or 7 years, and I loved it. I hated it in college. I loved it when I taught it. And part of the reason why is because I started to see, oh, there's commonalities. There's things that are similar here. And there was a principle that I found in chapter 2 that came up in chapter 3, that came up in chapter 5, came up in chapter 7. Wait a second. It comes up the whole way. And as I started to see that, I shifted how I taught, and it made it a whole lot more fun for the kids as well. All right. We're going to wrap up here. What do we want as math teachers? Why do you teach? So that we can shape students, so that their conduct is modified. And we do that by establishing the full force of the lesson so that they act upon it. And the way that we get there is through understanding math to a point ourselves where the deeper knowledge the knowledge and appreciation of the truth and its deeper significance and wider relations is made known. And really, it does all come back to the teacher. The teacher must know that which he must teach. And it's not an achievement. It's not a bar of knowledge, but it's a continual search and pursuit. These are the two other books that I mentioned earlier. Well, I don't think I mentioned the middle one. The middle one is a really helpful book as well. And the thing that the two books on the right, Arithmetic for Parents and Knowing and Teaching Elementary Math, helps you to do is to identify questions to ask of your own text. One of the things that I think it was in the middle book there, it said there are three types of subtraction problems. Did you know there's three different types? And if you're teaching elementary math, I would strongly suggest you identify the three types because there are different degrees of difficulty for a student. And as we can identify this in the upper lessons as well, upper grades, then that will be helpful. Thank you. Yes, sir.
Oh, we'll stay with you. I was wondering where you were going to go with this kind of stuff, but it was delivered succinctly. It was laid out before. You know, I pretty much run my race, but I feel good knowing there's young guys like you that are holding up on high standards.
Oh, well, I appreciate that.